ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week I'm joined by Peter of the Podstalgic Podcast, who's going to sit down and discuss Grace Kelly's career and performance in 1954's Dial M for Murder.
Do you really believe in the perfect murder?
Yes, absolutely. On paper, that is. But I doubt if I could carry it out.
Oh? Why not?
Well, because in stories, things usually turn out the way the author wants them to, and in real life, they don't.
I'd like to throw out a quick addendum before we start this week's episode. I erroneously thought that this was going to be a birthday tribute to Grace Kelly, when actually it's more of a tribute to the anniversary of her marriage to Prince Rainier of Monaco. So please forgive me when we mention in the main discussion that this is a birthday celebration, because it's not. Grace Patricia Kelly was born November 12, 1929 in Philadelphia. Her family was affluent. Her father was an Olympic medalist who ran for mayor of Philadelphia and would work with FDR as the National Director of Physical Fitness. Her brothers were an actor and a Pulitzer Prize-winning dramatist and director, respectively. Kelly's parents weren't pleased about her decision to take up acting. It was a job her father saw as, quote, a slim cut above streetwalkers. It wasn't until 1950 that director John Ford discovered Kelly and hired her to replace Jean Tierney in the remake of Red Dust, Mogambo, opposite Clark Gable and Ava Gardner. Kelly's career went up from there. In 1953, she turned down a role in Elia Kazan's On the Waterfront, which would eventually garner Eva Marie Saint an Oscar. But for Kelly, she found another role far more enticing, that of Margot Wendis in Alfred Hitchcock's Dial M for Murder.
You're trying to blackmail me into murdering your wife.
A few minutes' work, that's all it is. £1,000 in cash.
It's been said Alfred Hitchcock never got over losing actress Grace Kelly, his muse for three titles, Rear Window, Dial M for Murder, and To Catch a Thief. Based on the 1952 play by Frederick Knott, Dial M for Murder follows former tennis pro Tony Wendis, played by Ray Milland, as he plots to murder his philandering wife Margot, played by Grace Kelly. This being a Hitchcock film, and if you listen to the clip played earlier, things don't go quite as planned. You could also say the sentiment extends to the making of the film itself. Alfred Hitchcock made Dial M for Murder mostly to fulfill a contractual obligation. He'd originally intended to adapt a film called The Bramble Bush, but after the muted reception to his previous film, 1953's I Confess, a film that also got him some flack from the Catholic Church, The Bramble Bush's script and budget, Hitch had to abandon that project. He also didn't care that Warner Brothers really wanted to put 3D into this movie, which was a common sentiment most studios had, since 1954 is oft considered the year of 3D. The film's stage-bound aesthetic and procedural script played better in a previous Hitchcock film, 1948's Rope, and star Ray Milland doesn't quite fit the Hitchcock filmmaking style. He was a replacement for Cary Grant, and it actually sets the stage for his eventual doppelganger, James Mason, who premiered in 1959's North by Northwest. This, coupled with Hitchcock's own antipathy toward the project, could explain why this is really often only referred to in order to set up the warm relationship that he'd eventually have with his leading lady, Grace Kelly, who would reteam the year after for Hitchcock's much better received film, Rear Window.
When I picked up the phone, he must have come from behind those curtains and attacked me. He got something around my neck.
Something? What do you mean by something?
I think it was a stocking.
I see. Now, what happened then?
Well, then he pushed me across the desk. I distinctly remember feeling for the scissors.
Now, where were those scissors usually kept?
In that mending basket. I'd forgotten to put them away.
Now, what makes you think he came from behind those curtains?
Grace Kelly would win an Oscar playing the wife of a drunken playwright in The Country Girl, the same year as Dial M for Murder's release. Grace Kelly made five films in 1954 alone, but her career was coming to an end. She'd re-team with Alfred Hitchcock for her only film in 1955, To Catch a Thief, and close out her career in 1956 with two final features, The Swamp and High Society. In total, Grace Kelly was only on the screen 11 times. In 1955, while on a visit to Cannes, she met Prince Rainier of Monaco. Rumors abound that he was desperate to find a wife in order to secure an heir, to prevent his country from falling into French hands. Regardless, they were married on April 18, 1956, in an event dubbed the Wedding of the Century. Kelly became the people's princess, decades before Princess Diana captured the hearts of people everywhere, and became the newly minted people's princess. After her marriage, Grace Kelly still got calls from Hollywood from time to time. Alfred Hitchcock wanted her to play his leading lady in Marnie, but outcry from the people of Monaco because the character was a kleptomaniac forced her hand. Grace Kelly died September 13, 1982, at the age of 52. Next, special guest Peter and I will talk about Grace Kelly and Dial M for Murder when we return.
I charge you that on the 26th of September you did willfully murder Charles Alexander Swan.
Do you find the prisoner, Margot Mary Wendis, guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
Hello, everybody, and today I am talking with Peter from the Podstalgic Podcast. Peter, how are you doing today? Thank you for agreeing to be on and talk Grace Kelly and Hitchcock. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I've been podcasting going on 3 years now. Podstalgic is actually formerly Hydrate Level 4, which was also a movie podcast. And when I started, it was actually with my son, who was then 13. And the concept of the show was that I would introduce him to the movies I grew up watching and his generation's perspective on it. He got older. I felt he became a little less available because he was getting to, you know, after school activities and things of that nature. Recently, with Podstalgic, I've had different guests come on. It's kind of the same thing. Did you grow up with this movie? Okay, let's review that. Or I may do a newer movie that I might have missed a boat on. Just because there's just so many movies and so little time to watch them all, I often miss the really good stuff. Like, I have been using this as an example, Ex Machina. I hear it's a great movie. I missed out on it. So eventually, maybe I'll go and do something like that. So it's kind of rediscovering movies new and old.
You are a jack of all trades with your work. We are, of course, talking about Grace Kelly and Dial M for Murder today, from 1954, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. What are your overall thoughts on the film? Had you seen this before? Was this a first-time viewing? What are your thoughts on Hitchcock and Grace Kelly?
This was my second watch. I have watched Dial M for Murder before. It was a time where, right now, my youngest son is 4.5. And before he was born and before I got into podcasting, I was doing the whole Netflix deal, 3 movies at a time. And I had it set that I would get a new movie every single day. And so every evening I would watch a movie before going to bed. So there was a point where I was like, you know what, let me go back and watch some of these older Hitchcock movies, because I obviously know that he's a legendary director. And there are great movies that I've never seen. So I watched Your Rear Windows, and Dial M for Murder was definitely one of those. And I enjoyed it a lot. And I remember watching it and being like, wow, this is like a stage play. And then I found out that it was actually based on one. And you can really see it. And it's definitely something that I wish that I can go watch as a production, because it just, to see it done, just see if it's as effective as this movie. But I did watch it again in preparation for this mini review. Grace Kelly, now, I'm definitely familiar with the name. It's not somebody I can say, oh, I've watched like these movies of hers. She was also in Rear Window. It's been a few years since I've seen that one. So I've seen her in that. I've seen her in this. That's all I can say off the top of my head. You know, if you start naming other things, I might have to think about it, you know, whether yay or nay. But that's pretty much my history with Hitchcock and Grace Kelly in this movie.
When I have about the same review of this movie, because I watched this twice. This was my second time as well. The first time I watched it was because I had never really been well-versed in Grace Kelly's films. She only made 11 films.
Oh, wow.
Before she married Prince Rainier of Monaco and gave up film. She did 3 movies with Alfred Hitchcock, To Catch a Thief, this, and Rear Window. And he wanted to make more with her. I think he wanted to offer her The Birds, and she couldn't do it, which is why he got Tippi Hedren. He was always trying to recapture that Grace Kelly thing. So I watched the first time to see what Grace Kelly was like as an actress, and I thought this was fine. And I rewatched it again this time, and I noticed a few more things that I didn't really notice the first time, but overall I still said, it's fine. it's a little cold. I know that in the 50s, especially this and Rope, which was 1948, Strangers on a Train, Hitchcock really became intrigued by the procedural of how crimes are committed and how they're ultimately undone, which Rope is pretty much this movie with two men as opposed to a couple. A lot of this movie, and it's why you bring up it's a stage play, a lot of it is characters talking about what they're going to do, and then once they do it, how you can solve it. It's like reading an Agatha Christie novel. I felt overall that it was just a little too sterile for me. There's some big moments of action, but overall it's a very bare bones plot, which works to our advantage because it allows us to look at specific things, but I don't know if for me as an overall film viewing experience, it's something that I would say, you know, if it's on, I would watch, sit down, and commit the time to.
This time around, because obviously the first time I watched it was as a regular movie watcher. This time I put the whole podcasting hat on. We get the whole talk of the blackmail, and this is what I want to hire you for. I was like, that's a lot of talking. I don't remember having that thought the first time I watched it. You know, granted, that was a few years ago. Why are we going in full detail? Because we're going to see it happen. I guess just because of the source material, it is what it is. I got to agree with you. This time around, not as high on the movie, but I still did enjoy it.
It's a film that's admired more than revered or beloved, because you segued right into a talking point that I wanted to bring up, which is how much planning and deconstructing the film does. You're introduced to Ray Milland's, I was going to say James Mason because Ray Milland and James Mason are interchangeable for me. Ray Milland's character, Tony, who is meeting with this guy named Swan, played by Anthony Dawson. They're both lying to each other about who they are. And Tony comes out and says, I planned all of this. I mean, this is a person that has obviously premeditated this for over a year. He's pretty much invited this guy in to tell him, I want you to kill my wife. And it's about a 30-minute sequence of Ray Milland detailing how Swan's going to do this, why if Swan goes to the police, he's not going to be believed because of the fact that his fingerprints are on this letter and the fact that they do have this cursory connection to each other. Then the actual murder happens, and the movie from that point on becomes the inspector character, John Williams, discussing all the different ways that the murder as they see it, because Swan ends up dead, not Margot, Grace Kelly's character, essentially trying to prove how Margot did it. And then you have this third act where it's them trying to prove that Margot didn't do it. It's very well written, but it does lead you to say, when all is said and done, not a lot actually happens outside of the actual murder.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the murder is the only action and very little dialogue. You read Tony's face very well. He has to hear Margot being strangled, the ruffling on the other end of the phone there. I thought he played that well, actually. Scene itself, the murder, it was definitely tense because you're like, when is he going to strangle her? You know, she's on the phone, she's talking, and then you see him with the scarf. Aside from the murder, like you said, the first act, the third act, all talking. Again, I think with the whole podcasting hat on, I'm just like, I really do like the third act where Inspector Hubbard does his job because he does not believe Tony. Tony just seems a little too polished in his explanation, everything. One detail that I forgot about the plotting of this murder in the first act was the whole, like, I've been tailing you for 6 months and notice you've become a small-time crook. It's like, wow, a lot of thought has gone into this. Because wasn't this movie remade as The Perfect Murder with Michael Douglas?
It was remade in 1998 as A Perfect Murder, which I've seen both. Both films have their merits. I think A Perfect Murder condenses a lot of things in terms of combining the Halliday character and the Swan character into one person. We can touch on some of the changes I think the remake does that almost make that movie a bit worse for the Kelly character and better for the Kelly character. But Dial M for Murder feels like it's one of those movies that is a little too plotted, because you really have to suspend disbelief that these characters planned for every eventuality. There comes a point, especially at the end, where characters blithely say, well, I knew you were going to do this. Where I get that Agatha Christie element, because some of those books have plot devices where characters are aware of things that just seem like, really? You really knew that was going to happen?
Yeah, you got to suspend some disbelief there. And, you know, it's a product of his time. Writing isn't as tight as it can be now. I would welcome a remake that's written a little bit more believable. Now, Perfect Murder, I only caught like bits and pieces on TV. And at the time, I didn't know it was the remake. Is that something you would recommend?
We loved to remake film noirs in the 80s and 90s. And usually that was in the interest of having more sex. So you got the remake of Postman Always Rings Twice with Jessica Lange and Jack Nicholson. A Perfect Murder is a very glossy movie. It's very slick. It's got Gwyneth Paltrow. Viggo Mortensen's really good. Michael Douglas is, I think, a notch above a Ray Milland in terms of you can understand why someone as gorgeous as Grace Kelly or Gwyneth Paltrow would marry him. It does condense a lot, and it does change the end of the movie. And I think there are elements of A Perfect Murder where the Gwyneth Paltrow character comes off as a bit smarter. Then there are also moments, conversely, where she comes off as a bit too much of a victim, like we have to make her suffer. It's a product of the late 90s, but I think it's a fun movie.
What do you think about the third act? Now we're trying to prove that Margot didn't do it. I feel like this goes in Inspector Hubbard's favor, where he kind of gets one up on Tony.
The third act really plays on stuff that Hitchcock had done before in other movies, and that could be because he had to make this movie because of a contract obligation. Hitchcock really didn't want to make this, and I think you can feel that in certain scenes, especially in the third act when it becomes this emphasis on the latchkey. And we'd seen the latchkey plot about a decade before when he made a film called Notorious with Ingrid Bergman. There's an emphasis on characters passing keys, and here it's Tony swiping this key, swapping it, trying to make it look like Margot has this key the whole time. The third act is a little silly. Get to see poor Grace Kelly in like gray clothes with these psychedelic backgrounds that show the trauma that she's enduring in prison. And it really all boils down to trying to unlock the door with what's in her handbag. I think it becomes a little silly, but I mean, the movie is only an hour 45 minutes. I figured that by this point, Hitchcock's just like, we gotta come up with something. So it works, but it doesn't seem as complex, I think, as what precedes it.
I completely forgot that it was an hour 40, just because there's so much talking. You remove the talking, you're probably looking at like an hour 15, an hour probably. The talking is necessary, but some of it is just over exposition and too much rambling on. Do you think this could have been a good movie, just under 90 minutes?
I'm sure somebody would say, how dare I say that a Hitchcock movie should be shorter. Most of his movies are tightly paced for the most part. Hitchcock was coming off of a bomb before this. He had made a film called I Confess with Montgomery Clift and Ann Baxter, which is also a very talky affair. Here, it has to infuse some amount of exposition. Maybe because we're smarter audiences now who have seen all of this, you can really tell the exposition. So in that opening, when Tony's trying to say, you know, this is why she married me and we've been together this long, Grace Kelly opens the movie by saying to Mark, we were dating for a time and my husband was all of a sudden really nice to me. So you get a lot of characters having to give necessary backstory, but it makes the movie feel elongated because you know that this is all an exposition dump. You brought up the murder, which is probably the big action set piece of this movie. There's not a lot of action other than that. Watching it this time, I noticed the 3D elements. This was originally meant for a 3D release because in 1954, everything was 3D. 1954 was the year of 3D. It was a flash in the pan process because every movie did it, for good and ill. Hitchcock didn't want to do it as a 3D film, and if you watch it, there's hardly any 3D elements outside of a couple of scenes, predominantly, I think, in the actual murder scene where characters' hands are shoved out into the frame. Watching the actual murder this time, I didn't realize how sexually suggestive it was. He comes up behind her. He throws her on the desk. There's a lot of noise that could mimic sexual sounds, and you have Tony listening on the phone, not knowing what's happening. The plot is essentially him knowing that his wife has been cheating on him, so you have that sexual component on top of it. Hitchcock was a guy who's had a lot written about him and his depictions of women and his interest in rape fantasy elements. If you look at something like Marnie, it's filled with rapey imagery. And here, I was taken aback at just how sexually tinged the whole thing is. And I mean, keep in mind, she stabs the guy in the back with scissors. And if anybody's read Molly Hask, I think it's Men, Women, and Chainsaws. Women and Sharp Objects, the penetrative principle. I was really interested in how this movie is really about threesome. You have Tony, Margot, and Swan with the murder, and you also have Tony, Margot, and Mark. I don't know, maybe that was just me having my mind in the gutter, but was it something you noticed at all?
Not really, but now that you mention it, I do remember the scene starts off when she answers the phone and the camera pan maybe not quite 45 degrees, but there's a bit of a spin like around the room here, and you kind of get to see the background a little bit. But when she is attacked, there is a bit of a cut straight to her feet, and almost the way it's shot, it does look like, you know, she's being forced upon. So I could see that. Actually, it'd be interesting for me to go back and watch it to see after hearing you say that.
It's definitely something, maybe because I've seen so many Hitchcock films, and if you know the history of his very weird relationships with women, it's...
I've seen the movie.
There's Hitchcock, or there's The Girl, the movie about him and making King of Birds with Sienna Miller.
Okay, The Girl I have not seen. The Hitchcock, yeah, I saw.
Both of them are interesting in their own ways. But of course, it wouldn't be the Ticklish Business podcast if I didn't bring up the other thing I noticed, which was homoeroticism, which I tend to notice a lot. I noticed it mostly in the beginning, because Tony and Swan have this really weird dialogue that almost feels coded. They knew each other, and they're going to share this secret. And I think maybe for me, I noticed that because before this, again, in 48, Hitchcock had made Rope, which is about the Leopold and Loeb case. And that movie is so... it's not even subtext. It's a total homosexual affair in that movie. It's just, we don't really call it out as such, but it's there. So that was another thing I noticed. I mean, I think Dial M for Murder has a lot of really, really interesting sexual dynamics to it because it's such a small cast that it's hard not to read stuff as coded.
You don't think it's maybe just because they have like a bit of a history being acquaintances?
That could be it too, because they talk about that they went to school together and that they have this backstory. They're both mutually hiding something. They're both lying to each other. I'm sure somebody has written an essay or an article or something about the secret gay subtext in Dial M for Murder.
I could totally see it now that you say that. Maybe from Tony's side, the whole following him for 6 months and I saw a picture of you and wondering what you were up to. Like, could see that perhaps. Maybe there's a little bit of fascination with Swan as well, and that's why you were just so hell-bent in getting this particular guy. You were following this guy because you wanted to be sure that he was going to be the right guy. You could have maybe gone to somebody else that you didn't trust. Like, you trust this guy, really? But have you guys kind of been estranged? And
definitely putting a lot on the shoulders of a person that he's only presumably known very briefly and hasn't seen in several years. You know, when you watch murder shows, they usually hire somebody that has no connection to them to avoid somebody tying the threads together.
I think it'd be funny if we had some kind of deleted scene where Victor Hubbard finds like the picture of the class and like it's a circle, Swan's face. This is the guy.
With like a heart around it or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, a heart. I like that. A heart emoji.
We should talk about Grace Kelly. It is her birthday. This is why the episode's being recorded in honor of her. I think she's fine in this. Grace Kelly falls into two camps. People who love her as the people's princess before we had Princess Diana when she was Princess Grace of Monaco, and people who love to hate her and say she wasn't that good of an actress. And I've seen several of her films now at this point. Again, she only made 11. She did win an Oscar eventually for playing a country girl, which I'm one of the people that says that she didn't necessarily deserve that. It should have gone to Judy Garland. But I think she's good in this. I don't think Hitchcock really gave her due, because even in Rear Window and in this, she's given a bit more to do here. Rear Window, she's just the one that's sent out to go get herself in the victim role by spying on Raymond Burr. Here, she's got a bit more agency in that we know who she is. She has some personality, but at the same time, it's not really a taxing performance outside of that murder scene. She's removed from the narrative for significant portions of the third act because she's in jail. She doesn't really have any big scenes that really test her mettle. So I don't really think that Hitchcock ever really gave her anything significant to work with. I'm sure somebody can say, oh, it's all in To Catch a Thief, but I don't know. I don't think she has a lot here other than looking exemplary. And I love the fact that she's in these fantastic costumes, lounging on a Sunday in a full gown. I mean, it's amazing. But that's what she was known for, was being a beautiful clothes whore. I don't really think she has a lot of talent on display here.
I have to agree with you. Being in jail for the third act, and obviously she's got her action scene of the attempted murder, most of her dialogue was just in the very beginning between her and Mark, and then obviously with her and Tony. That's really it. And I don't think she did anything special the way this movie is. Everyone's just talking and you're in one room for most of the entire movie. Obviously with different shots here and there in other sceneries, but for the most part, it's the house. The other parts is just them talking. So it's kind of hard for even for everybody. Inspector Hubbard's got his moment at the very end of the movie. This is a difficult movie to try to give an opinion on one's acting, because I feel like you put most people in this movie, they're probably going to do the same. Also, having only seen two movies of Grace Kelly in, hard for me to compare her to the other one. It's been a few years for Rear Window. Just wanted to point out, you were just mentioning Princess Di. Grace Kelly actually died in a car crash. She had a stroke. That's very sad at the age of 52, so still very young.
It's amazing that she made such an impact on cinema, only being in 11 movies. And I think that's where a lot of people tend to err towards the fact that she was the first royal that we had in Hollywood that was actually royalty, you know, not like Frank Sinatra royal. But here, I find it really great that we had the production code still at this time, and you weren't supposed to reward bad characters. Yet the movie opens with Grace Kelly's character cheating on her husband, making out with another guy, and being very open about it. I think that's ultimately negated by her being traumatized for this entire movie. She essentially pays, quote unquote, for her philandering with almost being killed. But at the end, she's still allowed a happy ending. Because Hitchcock was known to subvert the code however he could. Again, I mentioned in a previous episode about how he got around the kissing restrictions with Notorious. But here, I don't necessarily, as a person who always rolls their eyes at how females are meant to suffer, the final girl principle. It does allow her to at least end up having a happy ending, even though you know that the character is still not a great person.
I think it was very ballsy at that time for the movie to open up that way. I never even looked at it that way. This is what you get for being an adulterer. But we'll still give you the happy ending.
And Deborah Carr and Olivia de Havilland were both offered this role before Grace Kelly. And I don't think either one of them would have been very good. I mean, Deborah, I always think of her as very formal. Olivia de Havilland, I think, would have been interesting to see, because she always played nice girls. And Grace Kelly is pretty perfect because the Wendises have this very clean image. Ray Milland's character's got the hair slicked back. He's always got his clothes right. Grace Kelly, again, is always in these remarkable gowns. I think you needed characters that almost looked a little too perfect. And Cary Grant was offered the role of Tony, but they didn't want him to play the villain, much like when he was in Suspicion. So I think that would have been interesting, because how did you feel about Ray Milland? I don't really care for him as an actor. And I think he's okay. He's good at playing the villain, standing in the corner, making faces, look at my handiwork. But I don't know. He shows his hand, I think, a little too much.
That obviously comes out in the dialogue. I thought he was fine. I really liked watching him, or at least waiting for him to unfold all the lies come up with to try to convince Inspector Hubbard of this other story that he's come up with. Kind of like that. I felt that he did feel a little guilt, you know, on the phone when he heard Margot being attacked. But I think maybe if this is something that he has planned for this long, I feel like he should have been a little bit more villainous. I feel like we kind of got that early on in the first act, but at the end, I'm not familiar with this guy at all. He's like a poor man's Jimmy Stewart, old version.
He's definitely got that formality that Jimmy Stewart has. If you've seen North by Northwest, it's why I always confuse him with James Mason. Because James Mason has that very distinctive voice, that dark hair, that same type of bearing. I know a lot of people like Ray Milland in The Lost Weekend. It's what he was nominated for an Oscar for, playing a drunk. And he always played a great sop. He's another one. I've never really seen him give a wow-worthy performance.
I feel like he looks like James Stewart from The Man Who Knew Too Much. That's what he looks like there. I almost thought it was him for a sec, because it's been a while since I've seen this movie. And I was like, oh no, that's not him. That's somebody else.
Ray Milland was not part of the Alfred Hitchcock stable of actors.
Right.
You know, someone like a Cary Grant or a Jimmy Stewart who made multiple movies with him. And I think that's why he stands out negatively a little bit, because he just doesn't seem like somebody that Hitchcock would have worked with. And yeah. I'm wondering how far down the list he was, because that he did want Cary Grant initially and he couldn't get him, and you start to wonder if maybe he was just floundering looking for somebody. We both agree, we recommend it as something that is a classic. It's definitely worthwhile.
Yes.
But for me, I don't know. I like Hitchcock more when he's dealing with characters against some great peril. I don't really like Hitchcock when he gets psychological. And I think the procedural films that he made, stuff like Rope, stuff like Strangers on a Train, they don't really connect with me just because they are so, not formulaic in the sense that they're predictable, but formulaic in that they are dealing with a very ingrained set of rules.
Like Vertigo.
Yes. Oh, Vertigo and I do not get along. Talk about issues I have with feminism and female presentation. Vertigo and I are at odds. I like horror Hitchcock. I'm sure somebody's going to roll their eyes and say that's Psycho. The Birds. I think Shadow of a Doubt does this better, where you have a character that is evil and you have another character trying to unravel what's going on without it feeling so stage bound. So if anybody is looking for what I think is the better version of this movie, just go watch Shadow of a Doubt from 43, because I think it does this better. It's Joseph Cotten and Teresa Wright. It's a really good movie. It does Hitchcock's procedurals without falling into reading like a recipe card. But Peter, what are your overall thoughts? Second time around, you recommend it?
Second time around, I still recommend it. Be aware, there's a lot of talking. It pays off at the end. It's almost like a really long version of Clue at the end, if anyone remembers that 1985 movie based on the board game. It's like that in a way, in a sense where you have people just questioning and trying to run through different scenarios. And I'm trying to think how many Hitchcock movies I've actually seen. I want to throw out a number. I want to say like maybe around 7 or 8. This would probably be just right outside of 5, if not 5.
And I'm assuming you would probably check out more of Grace Kelly's films after this, or is it enough to make you say, maybe she's not for me?
From what you said, you know, we talked about it, this particular role, I don't think it's fair for me to judge her on this role and the little that she had to do. I would be interested in definitely checking out some of her other stuff for sure. Maybe something you would recommend, I would definitely check out.
The Country Girl, I can understand why they gave her the Oscar. It's not the best role, I think, in that year. But considering that she had played beautiful, untouchable women, this is a significant step down for her that showed she could act. So that's the one I always say, you know, if you want to see Grace Kelly act, gotta watch The Country Girl, even though I don't think that she deserved the Oscar for it that year. High Society is another interesting one. It's a remake of The Philadelphia Story, so she's playing Katharine Hepburn. And that one's interesting because it's very much a big stars of the late 50s thing. So it's got Bing Crosby, it's got Frank Sinatra. But it is another beautiful remake that Grace Kelly actually does pretty good in. I don't know if she was meant for musicals, but she does very well in it. There's a couple other films in her 11 filmography, like Magambo, which is another remake, The Swan, To Catch a Thief, her last film with Hitchcock that I still have to see. But The Country Girl and High Society are definitely worth it if you want to see a different facet of Kelly's very brief career.
I think I will definitely check out The Country Girl and Shadow of a Doubt.
Shadow of a Doubt is such an interesting movie. And again, talk about weird sexual politics in that movie. You have two characters that have the same name that are related. It's really, really, really weird. Listeners, you can let me know what you think about Grace Kelly and Dial M for Murder. You can tell me that I'm completely wrong. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com and I'll read them on the next episode. I'd like to thank Peter once again for joining me today. Where can fans find and get in touch with you?
If you want to interact with me on Twitter, I am definitely very active on there, @Podstalgic. Again, that's the name of the podcast. But I do have a personal Twitter account where I talk. That's kind of where I go to just unravel my thoughts on sports and just randomness. That's @RipCitizen. Two different places you can find me there. But thank you again, Kristen, for having me.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please consider leaving a rating and review to help the show gain some more exposure. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, @gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at @ticklish_biz. Want to know about upcoming episodes before everyone else, or listen to shows early? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier film podcast. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Next time, I'll be joined by another special guest as we celebrate 1939's epic, Gone with the Wind. Till next time.